International relations scholar Emmanuel Wallerstein, who has argued for some time that the U.S. is in economic and political decline and can only mask this reality by military aggression abroad, asserts in a recent essay that it is probably, not certainly, the case that the U.S. will be forced to withdraw from Iraq before the presidential election in 2008. He continues, "This withdrawal must be put in the context of wars the U.S. has fought since 1945. The most important, in terms of its impact, economic cost, and emotional involvement of the American people, was Vietnam. The U.S. lost that war, and it produced a deep cleavage in the American people about who lost the war and whether the war could have been won had other policies prevailed." Wallerstein believes this Vietnam syndrome has never been healed, and the withdrawal from Iraq will be even more traumatic than the flight from Saigon in 1975. Two such defeats will be devastating and will show the real limits of U.S. power. The nation will have only two possibilities at that point. One is a profound soul-searching, which would lead the U.S. to reevaluate its self-image, its sense of what is possible in the world system, now and the future, and what kind of values it really believes in. That's Wallerstein. Regarding his first possibility, I will argue in this course that there is a Mount Everest of evidence based on 230 years of U.S. history, which reveals that such a fundamental reevaluation of our values as a people and nation has never happened. To think that we might engage in such soul-searching after an entire history of avoiding it would be to succumb to a profound and tragic error. Wallerstein tells us there's a second possibility. The U.S. would be overcome with deep anger about the loss of its primacy, look for scapegoats, and eventually move to gut the U.S. Constitution and the liberties it presumes to defend. This occurred in Germany after World War I. He believes that it would be a grievous disaster if the United States moves to any significant degree in this direction. Ultimately, in his words, it is what the U.S. thinks about itself and does about itself that matters, not only for the United States, but also for the rest of the world. To test Wallerstein's thesis on the direction the country will take regarding war and imperialism and the imperial presidency, we need go no further than the Iran Freedom Support Act passed by Congress in September and Representative John Conyers' dramatic reversal regarding the impeachment of President Bush. The Iran Freedom Support Act, which is a regime change act, is remarkably similar to the arrogant and imperialist Iraq Liberation Act passed under President Clinton in 1998. Fortney Pete Stark is the only congressional representative from California to oppose this bill. The House of Representatives approved it 397 to 21, with nearly every liberal Democrat voting for it. The Senate passed it by voice vote unanimously, with every liberal Democrat, for example, Biden, Boxer, Clinton, Feinstein, Kennedy, Kerry, voting yea. The imperial presidency has grown dramatically since 1945 under both Democrats and Republicans. It has perhaps reached a new and staggering height under the current Bush administration with outrageous and egregious assaults on the Constitution. In December 2005, John Conyers, one of the House of Representatives' most liberal members for nearly 40 years and former chair of the House Judiciary Committee, who has fought some fine battles on behalf of constitutional principles and oppressed racial minorities, issued an eloquent and powerful Constitution in Crisis statement on the imperial presidency, focusing especially on issues of war and foreign policy. It was a detailed list of impeachable offenses committed by Bush and other high-ranking officials. With the recent Democratic victory in the House and the Senate, and the return of Conyers to his former chairmanship this coming January, many citizens expected him to call for hearings on impeachment. But shortly after the election, Conyers stated, "I have agreed with Speaker to be Pelosi that impeachment is off the table. Instead, we agree that oversight, accountability, and checks and balances that have been sorely lacking for the last 6 years must occur. I firmly believe that we have brought these matters to the attention of the American people and the mainstream media, and that their verdict was reflected in the elections on November 7th. Conyers' disavowal of his earlier view on impeachment and the recent vote on Iran, among other things, should put to rest any illusions that there will be a serious reevaluation of the U.S. empire and imperialist aggression. Those who cling to the hope that a Democratic majority in Congress will lead to a reduction or end of U.S. violence against the Third World need to reexamine the bitter lessons of our history. In the post-World War II era alone, the staggering record of violence by Democratic presidents against poor people of color abroad, that is, by Truman, Kennedy, Johnson, Carter, yes, Carter, and Clinton, ought to teach us that savage wars of peace are not a Republican monopoly. U.S. imperial interventions against sovereign countries have tied Democrats and Republicans in a brotherhood of empire. It is a blood brotherhood that will not be changed by remaining in a state of denial about our nation's true history." Thank you.
You're listening to Professor Emeritus John Marciano's public course on empire as a way of life that meets monthly in Santa Monica, California. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. We'll return to the conclusion of this segment. John Marciano.
We are going to begin. Comments, disputations.
Did you say the one guy you were talking about was Kinzer or Kinsler?
Kinzer, Stephen Kinzer, K-I-N-Z-E-R. This book, Overthrow, is his most recent book. His previous book is called All the Shah's Men, which is specifically on the machinations of the Central Intelligence Agency and Kermit Roosevelt in overthrowing Premier Mossadegh, the elected leader of Iran, in 1953. Kinzer was, for a while, and I don't know the exact period, a reporter for the New York Times. And as I recall from reading some of his articles, I don't remember him being so militant in his language about U.S. foreign policy while he was with the Times. As often happens, some of these mainstream reporters leave the Times or CBS or whatever and then become amazingly critical of U.S. policy. And of course, when you go back, not just in Iran, but when you think about, again, Iran in 1953 and other countries, the Iranians had this silly idea that they should probably control the oil underneath their own country. I don't know where they got that. And, of course, that certainly bothered the British. I mean, the British originally were the ones that fomented this little activity, and the U.S. got involved in it. And, of course, you know the incredible death and devastation and repression under the Shah from that point till 1979, which is the date that most people in the United States start the history of U.S.-Iranian relations. Most people here in the U.S. have absolutely no idea what happened in 1953 in Iran. Probably most people in the U.S. have no idea what happened in the United States in 1953.
John, your comment about what most Americans recall as their introduction to Iranian and American relations in 1979 is a perfect segue for my question, because I remember paying a great deal of attention to Frank Reynolds, and I think that was when Nightline began, as the Daily Count began. I don't ever recall any reports or any historical perspective given at that time about the fact that there was a democratically elected leader in 1953 and how the Shah came to power. Was there ever anything written during that time?
I probably followed it quite closely in the New York Times and on television. I don't recall much. Just an anecdote on that. In 1979, I was teaching at State University of New York at Cortland, and during the hostage crisis, two or three of us went into every dorm, and there was not a single student at Cortland who had, first of all, probably not a single student who even knew where Iran was, or as they pronounced it, Iran. No one, not a single student knew anything. Many of us did not know much, okay? I mean, it had nothing to do with our brain chemistry. So that whole history was not there, and the students were absolutely outraged that people would seize American hostages, some of whom, by the way, were CIA agents. I mean, you can read that in Kinzer's book. So you had to backtrack and talk about the previous history. And that's probably what happened with these reports on television, night after night after night after night, the countdown, right? Day 231, and, you know, and Jimmy Carter's anguishing. And
around that time, Penguin Books released, it was, I can't remember the title, but it was by Kemet Roosevelt, and it was basically his memoirs of overthrowing Dr. Mossadegh's regime in Iran. It was released right around the time the embassy was seized, and we had gotten like 6 copies. You know, we had ordered it before this whole thing happened. And we right away got a letter from Penguin recalling the book because of the situation in Iran. We refused to return the books. Of course, we didn't have many of them. But by the time they re-released it, everything had quieted down, and there was just no demand for the book, so it didn't stay around very long. But it was a copy of basically of his memoirs of American actions, which he was in charge of the CIA operation to overthrow Dr. Mossadegh in Iran and establish the Shah.
And those activities in Iran, paying people to have demonstrations, paying people to go out on strike, contacts with radio stations, etc., have been repeated over and over again. Very classic kinds of strategies. The most recent would be what happened in Venezuela, you know. And before that, 1970, even before Allende was elected in Chile, in the 60s, in Chile, but then especially under Allende, because you would remember then in Chile, these truckers are out on strike for months. They're not working. And you ask yourself, how are these people not working and surviving in a country, you know, where incomes are quite modest? And we saw this again in Venezuela. The episode, the overthrow in Iran, was done on what they called a cheap. There wasn't a lot of money pumped into this as compared to Chile 27, 37 years later. So this is a very classic pattern. It started, I mean, the CIA, of course, was formed in 1947 as part of the National Security Act under Harry Truman, and its first act of infiltration, subversion, was actually to disrupt and undermine the possibility of the left, that is, the Communist Party, winning the elections in Italy in 1948. And that included getting untold thousands and thousands of Italian Americans in the U.S. to write to their relatives in Italy, moaning and bemoaning if the communists came in power, you know, the Pope was going to be strung up on a rail, et cetera, et cetera. So that was done in Italy, and it was repeated in Vietnam. And many of us know the history of Vietnam, and some of that, you even see some of those kinds of things, even more violent, in Graham Greene's novel, The Quiet American. But in the most recent film, The Quiet American, with Michael Caine, which is a really, I thought, brilliant, powerful film. Unlike the original that came out, I think, in 1955 or 56, in which the producer or director actually sat down with people from the U.S. government to work over the script. That did not happen this time. So that's been going on, covert activities, as they call them. Quiet American.
A couple of things I saw in an article about it. It showed Mossadegh, he had visited this country, and he was in love. Mossadegh was a real Democrat. There he was with his hand on the Liberty Bell. There's a photograph of a guy with his hand on the Liberty Bell smiling. And also what shocked me is how little money it took to buy Iran. I mean, it was like $100,000 or something for the Congress, the cops, the top dog military leaders, to get a lot of people in the streets to create a brouhaha, to create, you know, chaos, what looked like chaos, because it was such a poor country in spite of the presence of oil.
And of course, following after that, Shah coming to power and the 26 years of repression and violence and murders, and a year after, 1 year right after the CIA pulled this off in Iran, it pulled off the coup in Guatemala. They did some of the same covert activities, and that unleashed the most genocidal violence in the Americas. Perhaps 200,000 people in Guatemala died in the period from 1954 up through, let's say, a couple of years ago. I mean, things are still going on. There's a very large Guatemalan exile community in Los Angeles.
It almost seems like they could depopulate.
That is what
happened. A small country like that. And to what possible virtue?
Well, the virtue is, it depends. Disproportionately, those who were killed were Mayan Indians. And then, of course, any dissenters, who were all called communists, of course, by General Rios Montt and others. The general, of course, was a visitor to the United States and was called a freedom fighter by Reagan, either shortly before or probably after Reagan had some of the Mujahideen visit from Afghanistan, and they were freedom fighters. And then they were replaced by the Contras, who were also freedom fighters. And thinking of your commentary on the photo of Mossadegh, I mean, you could imagine a wonderful photo montage of Rios Montt and Roberto Dubuisson and the Mujahideen all around the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. Now, that would be a photograph. And right alongside of them would be Sylvester Stallone. Okay, there's another question.
I didn't quite understand the way in which you said that Kinzer didn't have a deep enough grasp of the dynamics of a social movement that he was dealing with. At some point you said that, and I guess I thought you said that John Melville Foster was better on that. But maybe I misunderstood the... But anyway.
Yes, I've had the opportunity or maybe misfortune of having read Kinzer's book. I think as far as it goes, it's an excellent book. That's the book Overthrow. And by the way, and that's exactly what we'll do when we get to Grandin's book, because the book is case studies in Latin America, and Grandin will discuss in some detail the absolute horror in Guatemala. But Kinzer starts with Hawaii. You know, Hawaii, I think, came into the United States in 1959. So I was a 19-year-old college freshman. I mean, who knew about Hawaii? You know, Hawaii became a state. You figure, well, they wanted to be part of the United States. Who knew that 60 years before that, a group of these guys get together, before we had a CIA, and they plot a little thing, and they get rid of the queen in Hawaii. And they end up running Hawaii, you know, and you got Dole, and you got all these pineapples, etc. As far as it goes, because it is very factual, empirically based, he's really done his homework. Where I depart from Kinzer and many others who write these very powerful books, these exposés, is that there's almost a naivete, a lament that somehow this is not in the interests of the country. And I would argue that in terms of the people who run the country, it was in the interests of the country. It's not in the interest of the average people in this country to have the U.S. do what it did in Hawaii. And in Haiti, trying to think of the other thing, he talks about the Philippines, he talks about Guatemala, he talks about Iran. Again, there are 14 various regime changes. So regime change, of course, didn't start with the Bush gang. You know, we have these ideals. We're the city on the hill. We start from noble intentions. We're always trying to do good in the world. You know, we're like Johnny Appleseed, and we're just spreading all this democracy everywhere we go. And yet, when you start looking at the evidence from 1776, in terms of every single adventure of the U.S., I mean, that's how the U.S. grew. I mean, if we go back to Dunbar-Ortiz, I mean, those little 13 colonies, which, of course, were put together by invading someone else's society, it's as if he and others who write out of he doesn't write out of a radical anti-imperialist analysis, but a liberal analysis that essentially the institutions of the United States are mainly benign, but it is done, and Noam Chomsky put it best, saying that, you know, the U.S. makes mistakes, it never commits crimes. Well, I posit that if you start from the other basis, if you look at the evidence in Guatemala and Iran and Haiti and the Dominican Republic and Cuba and Panama, which, of course, Roosevelt helped create by taking apart of Colombia and getting a few guys that just take power, and then they decided, well, let's have a canal here, that it is not one accident after another of people always trying to do good. So I think his analysis does not match his empirical evidence. That is, he doesn't follow the logic of what he lays out, because if he did, he would, I think, come to the conclusion, aha, it looks like there's a pattern here. And the pattern is the U.S. always sides with the wealthy and powerful wherever it goes. There might be an accident now and then it'll end up supporting some populist leader, but that's extremely, extremely rare. So that's my disagreement with Kinzer. And there have been many, many books, many writers. And, well, all you got to do is look at the L.A. Times and the New York Times today. There's just article after article, month after month, over years, in which they're wonderful descriptive articles about what's happening in different places around the world. I mean, really fine, especially in the New York Times. But you can't expect the New York Times to give you the analysis that John Bellamy Foster does. So that's where I depart from these people.
Generally speaking, the argument is persuasive and forceful, and I'm in agreement with it. But I just wanted to take a little different tack based on one of the comments you made. You had mentioned that Lenin had said that there was imperialism in capitalism from the beginning. I believe that's the way it was stated. And that seemed logical to me. I would be in agreement, and I would think, well, you know, the aspects of greed and acquisition in capitalism would account for that, and it would be hard to argue with. However, it seemed to me on further thought that maybe state power rather than capitalism is a bigger generator of imperialism. And I say state power because it seems to me imperialism was in Soviet communism from the beginning, and maybe not based on sheer greed, but the notion of defense led to imperialist activities, the notion of ideological expansionism as an aspect of security and brotherhood and sisterhood, whatever. So as I thought about it, the issue became more complex in my mind and more daunting in the sense that, all along I've been thinking, well, if we get rid of this capitalism, we got a clear field. But state power by some other system that might take over might create a need to continue fighting. So it's a little different complexion. It's not in disagreement with what you're saying, but it adds a little dimension to it.
I think that while it takes us away from the central analysis of John Bellamy Foster, much of what you say is persuasive. I mean, the notion of great state power in the world and using the Soviet Union as an example could lend itself to becoming an empire. I mean, because you're sort of using imperialism and empire almost interchangeably. And so therefore, simply removing some of the fundamental economic props, let's say, or the foundations of a society wouldn't necessarily bring us some kind of nirvana in which people would say, well, now we're all going to live in brotherhood and sisterhood with everyone, and we're not going to possibly exploit anyone. We've got this society that's not built on greed, and yet here we are, 300 million people. Your argument would be the United States could have a dramatically different social and political system and yet be such a power that it could easily want for this notion of enhanced power to gobble up Mexico. I mean, they're right there, okay? Or Cuba's 90 miles away, or you know, because there always seem to be pushovers, the Canadians, 20 million, 22 million people. The notion of, not that it's some inherent force that's hardwired in the natural world, but that we've been a great power, and even though we've tried to solve these very fundamental economic problems, we still feel ourselves dominant to the Canadians or the Mexicans, and that danger could still exist. So I think you're right.
Three quick things, and then I'll take your response onto the mic. First, I believe that Greece was also the victim of a regime change.
In the 1960s.
The second thing, has anybody ever contemplated what the second world is, if there's a first world and a third world? I always have. And the third thing is, you know, this class is very interesting, but I would love, John, if possibly in the future you might contemplate, it would take some research, a class on imperialism from the point of view of the victims of our imperialism, like the Greeks, the Persians, the Filipinos. I think that would be more instructive.
Well, that'd be imperialism too, for those who really were out for some suffering coming back. But that's right, because because even in these analyses, we're starting from, while we do discuss in these articles and these books, we'll discuss the victims of the U.S. empire. It is, of course, the primary thrust is about the United States. And I would argue, in fact, that is the place you have to begin to understand the assault on the rest of the world. It starts at home, just the way violence against women and children starts at home. And way back when we talked about, for those of you who really have a good memory, when we talked about Columbus, the first evening, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, the first Zin group, the second Zin group, that it was very hard for U.S. citizens to condemn Columbus because he's one of us. Okay, he's like the father who's at the table, who is oppressing and violating us and our mother and our aunt. And it's easy for us, of course, to condemn, you know, what Hitler did to the Jews and gypsies, etc., and what Pol Pot did and what Idi Amin did. But to look across the table at our own father and to suggest that he's a mass murderer, that is hard. So the analysis, I believe, in order to do an effective analysis at first, and if you just stay there and don't talk about the victims, then it is a partial analysis. But in order to understand what we do in the world, you have to start by what we do at home and an analysis of this system. And I remember during the Vietnam War, it was a time of amazing political posters, and I remember seeing a poster or something, and it was a quote from Lyndon Johnson, if something to the effect that if you want to understand what we're doing abroad, look at what we're doing at home. And then some people kind of flipped that and said it was a poster that said something that freedom is the same in Mississippi and Vietnam, or democracy is the same in Mississippi and Vietnam. If we had a democratic society and a society that did not enslave and oppress people of color in Mississippi, we would not be killing and oppressing people of color in other countries. That's the argument. So the focus is essentially going to be on home. And your point about Greece is right. In fact, Greece was the first, even before the Italians. I mean, you know, my extended family is Greek, so I'm upset that the CIA went after Greece before Italy, but we'll just have to live with that. But that was the Truman Doctrine and the effort by the British, of course, who couldn't sustain it, but then the U.S. picked up to support the destruction of the partisans, which included communists in Greece, because they were in the forefront of resisting the Nazis. And what the U.S. supported in Greece, of course, and we ended up with the colonels and others in Greece, and as reflected in Costa-Gavras's film Z, was supporting the worst Nazi elements who had played ball with the fascists, with Italians and Germans in World War II. That's who the U.S. supported in Greece to crush that movement. And, of course, it was framed in the United States as stopping communism and stopping the Soviet Union. And people who make that argument know nothing about the documents which reveal that Stalin cut a deal with Churchill at Yalta in which Stalin forced Tito in Yugoslavia to pull any armaments away from the Greeks, and he refused to support the communists in Greece and allowed the British and the Americans to crush the left. And that's exactly what happened in Italy, by the way. And for those of you film fans, near the end of Bertolucci's great, magnificent political epic, 1900, you see the partisans turning over their weapons in Italy at a certain point in the war. Some people argue that the partisans, the resistance in Italy, would have won and that the U.S. Army would have been forced to withdraw from Italy. So that Greece, Italy, Iran, Guatemala, Vietnam, it's like a snowball effect.
Did you see this? The Nation, August of 2006.
Too late for Empire.
It says, too late for Empire, Jonathan Schell.
Yeah.
Maybe you can go on a bit about that.
You know, I'm a big fan of Jonathan Schell in the sense that he writes with incredible eloquence and power about what is happening in the world. And some of us first came to Jonathan Schell's writings in The New Yorker during the Vietnam War, and then his book, The Village of Ben Suk, which was a classic on the Vietnam War and the destruction of this village. The problem with Jonathan Schell, I would suggest, would be the same problem with Kinzer, is that I think Schell will still be writing these kind of articles 25 years from now because he and others at The Nation, and I've been reading The Nation for decades, excluding Alexander Coburn and a few others, simply are not going to be able to look in the mirror and come to the conclusion that what they describe, war after war after war, is bound to happen once you grant the premises of this system. It's not going to stop in Iraq, in Iran, in Afghanistan, in Central Africa, I don't care where it is, until you dismantle the empire. They have to give us endless wars, and that means the Democrats, and that means whether it's Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, I don't care who it is, they are not going to have a problem. Whether it's Hillary killing women in other countries and Obama is not going to have a problem killing Africans in Africa, just like Colin Powell did not have a problem when he was National Security Advisor for Reagan during the period when the U.S. supported the most brutal, brutal attack on movements in Mozambique, in Angola, in South Africa, in Namibia. You know, it's the empire comes first, and color be damned. You know, gender be damned. I mean, that's what it is. That's what it is. And Schell will anguish about it and write eloquently about it, but the system that produces the anguish is what he just can't come to grips with. Sure, you had a...
I wanted to kind of go back to what you were saying and what you were saying and say that, to me, what this is a process of deconstructing the American myth, which forms our identity. I mean, we are the empire. We are citizens of the empire. We may not like it, but we don't have anything in our head to replace it yet, which is the problem of Hillary and Obama and everybody else. And assuming the United States steps down from this stage one day, if the people in this country wise up enough to force them to do so, or if we become bankrupt, what's to say another player with the same MO won't step in, just like we took over from Britain and they took over from France and so on and so forth. What we're confronted with here that a lot of people are realizing is that it's not just a question of deconstructing the myth of our national identity that we must solve. It's what identity do we need to construct to replace it that is functional for the survival of us as a species at this time on this planet? Because we are facing, if the same MO goes, you know, whether it's us or the Chinese or the Indians, or somebody else, and you have all these national players who are fighting over resources, we're not going to last another 100 years. But the scientists are saying all this. And it's funny because the religious people are saying the same thing from their point of view. And nobody's talking to each other. Nobody's saying that, okay, well, I taped this guy the other night who wrote a book on the periodic chart of the elements, a chemist. And I confronted him after his lecture in the Q&A, and said, I want to question your methodology and say, okay, you're talking about the reductionism of whether or not chemistry can be reduced to physics, you know, whether or not physics can explain everything. And reductionism, taken to its ultimate extent, says that what we know, what we can mathematically postulate, can explain all phenomena, including human consciousness. Okay, he said, you know, go from physics to chemistry to biology to psychology to philosophy to religion, okay. And what you've said in the course of your lecture is that, no, it can't. Yes, it does somewhat, but no, it can't really. So it's yes and no is the answer to that question in terms of going from just chemistry to physics. And I said, yet we are all conscious in this room. we all are having an experience that is not reducible by your own admission, as the physicists admit too, the ones who are good at it, say they cannot explain everything. They can only go so far with their quantum theories. Okay? But we are an instrument that is designed that has an ability to experience far beyond what we reduce simply by focusing on mathematics. And we're being told all kinds of things just by interacting with our environment right now. We're being told that our ways of interacting with each other and the planet are not going to be able to be sustained unless we form a new relationship inside ourselves of who we are to each other and the planet. And, I mean, I see deconstructing our history, deconstructing who we are as a person, as a member of a country or whatever, as a part of that process, you know. And we have to be good at that and become teachers of it. I mean, and you look at the globe from outer space, there are no countries. These are all myths held in the minds of people. And some of them are useful to a certain extent, and some of them are going to get in our way. And we have to figure out which ones we need to throw away and which ones might be useful.
And that process is, I'm reading a lot of Eric Fromm, the psychoanalyst, who's one of those, of course, who escaped from Germany, who left Germany with others in the Frankfurt School. That process of trying to confront these issues is not just a sociological, economic process. I don't know much about the chemistry and physics part, but it is such a profoundly psychological thing that is so internalized. Two of the books I'm reading, Fromm's book, The Sane Society and Escape from Freedom. And in terms of our internalization of America and God bless America and this about America, and I mean that is those of us raised here in the U.S., have gone to U.S. schools, and the flag and Columbus and Washington and Lincoln, wandering around Santa Monica. There's John Adams Middle School, okay? There's Lincoln. There is Roosevelt, and there's Franklin, okay? And I went to a high school called East High School. I mean, so we didn't. The internalization, because what I think some of this analysis is suggesting, and that's why I find myself, I'm sure as you, getting sometimes deeply anguished about this, as I think anyone will try to study this, is that to look in the mirror and suggest that most of this construction, these myths were myths and lies, and that we didn't know and people didn't help us with the tools to understand this. And then ultimately, how all this connects with the fate of the Earth. I mean, Shell's book then was talking about nuclear war, but to raise it even to the greatest, the fate, literally, of Mother Earth, that you're right, with all of the wars and imperialism and resource struggles, we may be at the point, you know, of no return for the Earth. Forget about rebuilding Iraq or Iran or New Orleans. So to look in the mirror is really to ask of people an emotional and intellectual. I think intellectually, I found at this point in my life, after, you know, oppressing myself for 40 years of reading this stuff, that intellectually, to me, right now, I think it's a cake to be able to understand U.S. history and what has happened, as opposed to understanding ourselves and, you know, relationships and those kinds of things. But understanding it emotionally, because I was raised here. My parents were born here, though I was raised with my grandmother, who never spoke English. But, you know, I'm quote-unquote an American. And, you know, in 1954, as a 14-year-old teenager, I'm not thinking about or even know anything about Guatemala. I'm wondering whether the New York Yankees are going to beat the Cleveland Indians in the American League pennant, which they didn't, by the way. So that's what it was to be an American, and if you're straight American, to meet girls and to worry about the Yankees or to worry about what's happening here and there and have no knowledge whatsoever that while I am enjoying this summer in Point Lookout, Long Island, on the beach, there are people being massacred in this country called Guatemala, okay? And to deconstruct that means to really go to the absolute core of our being. And most of us do not. Most people here, or in any country, the French, whatever, their own myths, do not want to do it even intellectually. Forget about emotion.
You have been listening to Empire as a Way of Life, a lecture and discussion series given by Dr. John Marciano. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org.
Finally, we'll conclude this week's program with a reading from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of Education, which has been on hiatus for a couple of weeks. This week, we'll begin Chapter 11, The Crunch, that deals with the school's role in creating an official Americanism. Gatto is a former award-winning New York teacher who left the profession in disillusion after a 30-year career and has become a prominent critic of a system that he sees as more about social control than education. Gatto begins, "The experience of global war gave official school reform a grand taste for what was possible. Government intervention was proclaimed the antidote for all dissent. In every nook and cranny of American life, new social organizations flourished, all feeding on intervention into personal sovereignty and family life. A new republic was here at last, just as Herbert Crowley announced, and government school was its church." He begins the first section with a quote from Walter Lippmann, speaking before the Association for the Advancement of Science, December 29, 1940, quote, "The thesis I venture to submit to you is as follows, that during the past 40 or 50 years, those who are responsible for education have progressively removed from the curriculum of studies the Western culture which produced the modern democratic state, that the schools and colleges, therefore, have been sending out into the world men who no longer understand the creative principle of the society in which they must live, that, deprived of their cultural tradition, the newly educated Western men no longer possess, in the form and substance of their own minds and spirits and ideas, the premises, the rationale, the logic, the method, the values of the deposited wisdom which are the genius of the development of Western civilization. That the prevailing education is destined, if it continues, to destroy Western civilization, and is in fact destroying it. I realize quite well that this thesis constitutes a sweeping indictment of modern education, but I believe the indictment is justified, and here is a prima facie case for entering this indictment." Close quote. And Gatto writes, "In 1882, an Atlantic Monthly writer predicted a coming struggle for the preservation of the American social order. European immigrants were polarizing the country, upsetting the, quote, homogeneity on which free government must rest, close quote. The idea of a necessary homogeneity made it certain that all lanes out of the 1880s led to orthodoxy on a national scale. There was to be an official American highway, its roadbed built from police manuals and schoolteacher training texts. Citizens would now be graded against the official standard, up to the highest mark, 100% American. In the 30 years between 1890 and 1920, the original idea of America as a cosmopolitan association of peoples, each with its own integrity, gave way to urgent calls for national unity. Even before World War I added its own shrill hysterics to the national project of regimentation, new social agencies were in full cry on every front, aggressively taking the battle of Americanization to millions of bewildered immigrants and their children. The elite-managed, quote, birth control movement, which culminated 100 years later in the legalization of abortion, became visible and active during this period, annually distributing millions of pieces of literature aimed at controlling lower-class breeding instincts, an urgent priority on the national elitist agenda." Okay, I'm going to break in here. I'm not going to dispute that there were persons involved in the birth control movement for that reason. The birth control movement was started by women, and its primary purpose is the freedom and human dignity of every woman, and that is her ability to decide whether or not, and when, if so, she will bear children. I just had to insert that because I really have a problem with his slant here. So, you know. Anyway, here we go, continuing with Gatto. Malthus, Darwin, Galton, and Pearson became secular saints at the Lawrence and Sheffield scientific schools at Harvard and Yale. Judge Ben Lindsay of the Denver Children's Court, flogging easy access to pornography as an indirect form of sterilization for underclass men, was a different tile in the same mosaic as was institutional adoption. The Planned Parenthood movement, in our day swollen to billion-dollar corporate status, was one side of a coin whose obverse was the prospering of abortion, birth control, and adoption industries. In those crucial years, a sudden host of licensing acts closed down employment in a wide range of lucrative work, rationing the right to practice trades as much as kings and queens of England had done. Work was to be distributed to favored groups and individuals who were willing to satisfy screening commissions that they had met qualifications often unrelated to the actual work. Licensing suddenly became an important factor in economic life, just as it had been in Royal England. This professionalization movement endowed favored colleges and institutes, text publishers, testing agencies, clothing manufacturers, and other allies with virtual sinecures. Professional schools, even for bus drivers and detectives, imposed the chastening discipline of elaborate formal procedures, expensive and time-consuming, quote, training, on what had once been areas of relatively free-form career design. And medicine, law, architecture, engineering, pharmacology, the blue ribbon work licenses, were suddenly rigorously monitored, rationed by political fortune. Immigrants were often excluded from meeting these qualification demands, and many middle-class immigrants with a successful history of professional practice back in Europe were plunged into destitution, their families disintegrating under the artificial stresses. Others, like my own family, scrambled to abandon their home culture as far as possible in a go-along-with-the-crowd response to danger. I want to interject here again. You can see, of course, why a lot of people would want to have some sort of qualification guidelines for doctors or architects. Once those guidelines are established, the question always is, who establishes them? Who enforces them? And to what purpose? Anyway, continuing. One of the hardest things for any present-day reader to grasp about this era was the brazenness of the regimentation. Scientific management was in its most enthusiastic public phase then, monumentally zealous, maddeningly smug. The state lay under effective control of a relatively small number of powerful families, freed by the Darwinian religion from ethical obligation to a democratic national agenda, or even its familiar Republican/libertarian antithesis. Yet these antagonists comprised the bedrock antinomies of our once revolutionary public order. And without the eternal argument they provoked, there was no recognizable America. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Between 1890 and 1920, the percentage of our population adjudged feeble-minded and condemned to institutional confinement more than doubled. The long-contemplated hygienic form of social control, formulated by 18th-century German social thinker Johann Frank, complete medical policing, was launched with a vengeance. Few intimidations are more effective than the threat of a stay in an insane asylum. Did the population of crazies really double in these three decades? The answer given by one contemporary was elliptically Darwinian, quote, "Marriage of these inferiors is a veritable manufactory of degenerates," close quote. It could no longer go unchecked. The American Birth Control League left no doubt about its plans. Its position, as expressed by Yale psychologist Arnold L. Gessel, was that society, quote, need not wait for perfection of the infant science of eugenics before proceeding upon a course which will prevent renewal of defective protoplasm contaminating the stream of life, close quote. Gesell's The Family and the Nation, published in 1909, a thorough product of the new zeitgeist, advocated, quote, eugenic violence, unquote, in dealing with inferiors. According to Gesell, quote, we must do as with the feeble-minded, organize the extinction of the tribe, close quote. Here was a far different promise of American life, a Connecticut Valley Yale-style pledge. Yet the governors of the Birth Control League were acclaimed heroes in every progressive assembly. With this, old-line Calvinism converted its theological elements into scientific truth, supported mathematically by the new Galtonian discipline of statistics. Yale was the most important command center for the reemergence of old-time Puritan religion, now thoroughly disguised behind the language of research methodology. The eugenics movement, begun by Galton in England, was energetically spread to the United States by his followers. Besides destroying lesser breeds, as they were routinely called, by abortion, sterilization, adoption, celibacy, two-job family separations, low-wage rates to dull the zest for life, and above all, schooling to dull the mind and debase the character, other methods were clinically discussed in journals, including a childlessness which could be induced through easy access to pornography. At the same time, those deemed inferior were to be turned into eunuchs. Galtonians advocated the notion of breeding a super race. Humanist Scott Nearing wrote his masterpiece, The Super Race, An American Problem, in 1912. Just as the drive to destroy an academic curriculum in public schools was reaching its first crescendo. By problem, Nearing wasn't referring to a moral dilemma. Rather, he was simply arguing that only America had the resources to meet the engineering challenge posed in creating supermen out of genetic raw stock. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. The, quote, visionary theories soon to be imposed on America belie our myth of the melting pot as some type of spontaneous sociological force. The two great mass immigration periods, 1848 to 1860 and 1871 to 1914, posed a threat to the course of national development that was underway. The unique American experience of creating a particular New World culture was still too green, too recent an historical phenomenon to tolerate the sophisticated competition of pluralism. A cosmopolitan society like that of 5th century Roman England wasn't possible for America to accept without damaging its growth. The possibilities inherent in a bizarre society were at once exciting and anxiety-provoking to Americans, just as they were to Horace Mann. Yet beneath a sophisticated mask and veneer of cosmopolite civility, certain factions sought release from their uneasy ambivalence. There was only one realistic solution to human variability, the solution of the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, popularly known as the Know-Nothing Party. You must be as we are. Those who surrendered to such pressure, as many newcomers did, were ultimately worse off than those who insulated themselves in ghettos. Some pages back, I referred to the brazenness of our new social arrangements, a sense of vulgar pushiness the reader senses radiating from various temples of reform. In some crazy way, the ornamentation of the period carries the flavor of its arrogance. It prepares us to understand the future, that time in which we now live, our own age, where home cooking means commercially homogenized food product, microwaved, where an entire nation sits down each evening to commercial entertainment, hears the same processed news, wears the same clothing, takes direction from the same green road signs, thinks the same media-inculcated thoughts, and relegates its children and elders to the same scientific care of strangers in schools and, quote, nursing homes. A signpost of the times. In 1920, the Henry Ford Publishing Company distributed 2 million free copies of its recent bestseller to all libraries at all schools in the nation. The book, The International Jew, World's Foremost Problem. Adolf Hitler was still a poor war hero, living in Munich with Ernst Hanfstaengl, the half-American Harvard graduate whose mother was one of the legendary New England Sedgwicks. Hitler had Hanfstaengl read Ford's book to him. In the pages of Mein Kampf, Ford is lavishly praised. Of Ford's other efforts to define the 100% American, at least one more deserves special mention. Speaking and writing English had very little to do with work on a Ford assembly line, but Ford decided to make English language classes compulsory. The first thing foreign-speaking Ford employees learned to say, quote, "I am a good American," close quote. Ford students were graduated in a musical extravaganza that bears close attention as an indicator of the American spiritual climate after World War I. A huge black pot took up the middle of the stage, from which hung a large sign that read, "Melting Pot." From backstage, an endless procession of costumed immigrants descended into the pot on a ladder reaching into its bowels. Each wore a sign identifying his former homeland. Simultaneously, from either side of the pot, two other streams of men emerged, now converted into real Americans, dressed in identical clothing. Each waved a small American flag, while a brass band played "America the Beautiful" fortissimo. Wives and children cheered wildly when the cue cards were flashed. It was nothing short of marvelous that world champion Jew baiter Henry Ford, architect of the most opulent and sinister foundation of them all, major player in the psychologization of American schooling, was a closet impresario in the bargain. Ford completed America's philanthropic circle. Three great private fortunes were to dominate early 20th century public schooling: Carnegie's, Rockefeller's, and Ford's. Each with a stupendous megalomaniac in charge of the checkbook, each dedicating the power of great wealth not to conspicuous consumption but to radical experiments in the transformation of human nature. The hardest lesson to grasp is that they weren't doing this for profit or fame, but from a sense of conviction reserved only for true believers. There was no room in America for the faint-hearted. If a man wanted to be 100% American, he had to reject his original homeland. Other Americanizing themes were heard, too. General Leonard Wood growled that the Prussian practice of universal military service was the best means to make the unassimilated, quote, "understand they are American," close quote. By the time I graduated from high school in 1953, universal military training took me away to Kentucky and Texas to become an American, I suppose. After government school, government army, and Anglican Columbia were through with me, I had lost the map to get back home. All over the American Midwest, fitter families competitions were held at state fairs and expositions, ranking American families by objective criteria, much as hogs or cattle are ranked. Winners got wide play in the press, ramming the point home to immigrant families that the mustard would be cut in the land of the Star-Spangled Banner by mathematical checklist attention to recipes and rules. After all, God himself had probably been a research scientist, or so William Rainey Harper, president of the University of Chicago, declared to the nation. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. You can find out more about John Taylor Gatto's work on the web at johntaylorgatto.com, where this book can be downloaded in its entirety. And you can download this and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests on the web at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.